This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Kinder, Kirke, Kuka. Or children, kitchen, and church. It's a phrase with a long history in Germany, but by the 1930s, it was pulled to the center of how the Third Reich defined the purpose of women in Nazi Germany. Womanhood, in fact, was narrowed and restricted down to one purpose: service to the Nazi state. By 1933, the Nazi Party issued a list of principles for the National Socialist Women's League, which stated, quote, "We reject the misguided direction of the democratic, liberalistic, international women's movement because they have not discovered new paths based on God and nationhood. We want an awakening, a renewal, and a re-education of women. A woman's entire education, development, vocational pursuit, and position within Volk and state must be directed toward the physical and spiritual task of motherhood." End quote. And in fact, in Nazi Germany, women themselves championed the subservience. Here, an actor reads what Jutta Rüdiger, head of the Nazi Party's League of German Girls, described as their mission in 1939.
"Men and women, boys and girls, must carry out their duty according to their station. Boys we raise as political soldiers, and girls as the comrades of these political soldiers. We teach them to be wives and mothers, and to breed the next generation. That's all."
The rolling back of women's rights and roles in society wasn't limited to Nazi Germany. From 1934 all the way to 1975, the women's section of Spain's fascist party was the state's organizing tool with authority over women. It counted more than 680,000 members who tried to shape Spanish women into their model of the ideal woman: a Catholic, dedicated, self-sacrificing mother and obedient wife. Quote, "The true duty of women to the patria is to form families," women's section founder Pilar Primo de Rivera said. "What we will never do is put ourselves in competition with men." The same goes for roles and rights of women in Mussolini's Italy. In fact, defining down womanhood is a hallmark of populist ultranational movements both then and now. A 2017 UN Special Report on Global Cultural Rights found that much of the contemporary assault on cultural rights emerged from populist ultranational movements that disregard key principles of equality and the universality of human rights. And one of the earliest places those rights are restricted are in the lives of women. So that's what we're going to look at today. And joining us is Anne Winginter, professor of history and women's studies at Loyola University Chicago's John Felice Rome Center, and she's with us from Rome, Italy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Meghna. Very, very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wonder, I'd like to focus with you, obviously, on what we can learn, the lessons we can learn from Mussolini's in Italy when we think about the rights of women. But where should we start our analysis? I mean, because I feel like everything that has to do with World War II really dates, we really should look back further to, you know, even the interwar period, to the end of World War I.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think, I mean, we could push it back even a little further. There's a, you know, a kind of growing consensus among historians that the Industrial Revolution causes a kind of crisis in masculinity that is exacerbated by the First World War, and certainly Italian fascism, which is the area that I study most, is in many ways a reaction to the experience of the First World War and the kind of disorder in its immediate aftermath. And fascism is founded in Italian fascism. The first fascism is founded in 1919, so just really months after the end of World War I.
So tell me more then about why this crisis of masculinity informs Italian fascism in particular, because of course these dates that we're talking about also, you know, at least in the United States, coincide with, you know, the suffrage movement as well.
Sure. Well, I mean, the Italians women's movement, sort of first wave feminism in Italy, is really just kind of nascent at the beginning of the 20th century, and Italian women are largely without political rights when fascism emerges on the scene. I think, however, and also Italy is something of a late industrializer, so there is this kind of perception of a crisis really before the reality has fully taken hold, that's, you know, sort of growing and then exacerbated by the First World War, the sense that traditional patriarchy is threatened by new patterns of labor, first with industrialization, and then the war itself. You know, at the propagandistic level, kind of exalts old images of the male warrior, of the active soldier. But the experience of World War I is largely a passive experience for men. You know, soldiers fighting as kind of cogs in the war machine, really not about individual heroism, but about kind of, you know, cowering in trenches until things happen to you. So I think there is, a contribution to early fascism there, this kind of deliberate attempt to evoke the more idealized vision of the soldier, the division between the war front and the home front, in some ways in an attempt to kind of counteract what had been the reality of the war experience.
Mm. So then you heard me at the beginning describe a little bit about how women and womanhood was viewed in Nazi Germany, under fascism in Franco's Spain. How did the Italian fascists view what a woman was supposed to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar, right? Mussolini's was known for his kind of pithy little quotes and his on record of saying, you know, war is to man as maternity is to woman. The ideal woman in fascist Italy was, you know, the wife and mother of many children, because there is a kind of demographic panic in the wake of the First World War in Italy. One who is essentially this kind of patriarchal vision, but one who is at the same time dedicated to the state. So I think that's an important distinction, you know, that's there in the quotes that you read, but also needs to be emphasized, right? That this is not just an attempt to turn back the clock to the women's sphere at home and kind of limited to that, but it is an attempt to kind of nationalize motherhood, if you will. So the woman is supposed to be sort of subservient to men, and her ideal place is in the home raising children, but those children are children for the state,
right?
Not for the family, not for the church, but for the state.
And so, and this is really an important point, because in my reading of the writing and analysis regarding Nazi Germany and Spain in particular, and it sounds like it's very similar in Italy, raising children and large families for the state was then couched as sort of an exalted duty, right, for women. So it wasn't that you will be made subservient. It was that you are performing a unique duty that men themselves cannot perform for the greatness of the state.
Absolutely, and this is the thing that attracted many of those women that you mentioned. For many women, this was seen, and, you know, in Italy in particular, you know, some of the early feminism in Italy was explicitly maternalist, right? This idea that women could be a maternal influence on society and could extend that influence into the public sphere. And, you know, many women in Italy, but also in many of these other fascist movements and places where fascism comes to power, see this as a kind of recognition of their importance, even as there are policies and laws passed to try to constrain them to a limited space.
Yeah, so we'll definitely talk about those policies and laws, because that's sort of the where we're wondering if we're hearing echoes today in the United States and in other places around the world. But this idea that there was this view of empowered fascist women is fascinating to me, right? Because I was reading some of the statements again of fascist women in Spain who said that they were saying there that it was a new Spanish woman emerged, brave, open, and free, and they who also had this concept of duty. It's really fascinating to me. And in Italy, was there that same sense? Because I have seen videos of Mussolini speaking before crowds of 60,000, 100,000 women, even.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the thing about fascism is that it's a really contradictory experience for women. And, you know, our view of it will often change depending, you know, if you're looking at it from the top down, the picture is very simple. We know exactly what the fascists wanted from women. They never tired of saying it. What's really complicated is trying to understand from the bottom up. That is, how did women experience those policies? Because at the same time, they're being told, you know, go home and have children, you know, so that we can, you know, build the army of the future or expand colonially or for whatever reason. But at the other, you know, at the same time, they're being mobilized to come to rallies. They have roles in public parades. They're brought to Rome to receive prizes if they have, you know, more children than anyone else in their province, right? So there is this kind of push-pull between this idea of a traditional place that they have to stay, but also this recognition, this place in the public sphere. And so women experience that in really contradictory ways.
Yeah. Well, Professor Anne Winginter, stand by here for just a second. We're talking about women's rights and also what happens to those rights when democracy begins to backslide. We'll have a lot more in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at what happens to women's rights in particular when democracy begins to backslide. And we're starting our analysis by looking at the examples that bring this question into sharpest relief. What happened with women's rights in the fascist regimes of Nazi Germany, Franco's Spain, and Mussolini's Italy? And I'm joined by Anne Winginter. She's a professor of history and women's studies at Loyola University Chicago's John Felice Rome Center. And she's with us from Rome, Italy. And professor, just before the break, you were talking about awards being given to women in Mussolini's Italy for having the most children. That reminded me, Nazi Germany had something similar, right? The Motherhood Cross.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, again, how this then, this sort of redefinition of womanhood in Mussolini's Italy was advanced through laws that the state passed. What are some examples?
So there were, I would say, like a combination of sort of punitive pronatalist policies and then policies that were attempts to encourage and laws that were attempts to encourage raising of the birth rate. So, for example, information about birth control, giving information about birth control became a criminal offense. Abortion, which had already been illegal, but largely, you know, not very closely monitored, let's say, was criminalized. with women facing up to 5 years of penal labor for consenting to abortion. There were child checks, so marriage loans to encourage early marriage, and those loans would be sort of progressively paid off with the birth of children. There was a tax on bachelorhood. There were job preferences given to married men over single men, men with children over men without children, men with multiple children over men with, you know, only a few children. The aforementioned prizes for, you know, for having large families, things of that nature. And then also quotas placed on women's employment, because it was believed that, you know, women's employment, women's advancement in the workplace or in education were barriers to fertility. And so there were attempts to kind of limit the number of women in the workplace, limit women's access to high schools and to university. Now, there were small numbers of women achieving higher education at that time anyway, but these laws made it much, much more difficult.
And how rapidly were these laws passed in Italy?
Well, they really begin. So, you know, we have to remember that fascism is invented in Italy, mm-hmm. and, you know, in its early years, they're kind of making it up as they go along. So there's a number of contradictions in early fascism. Fascists, you know, aren't really fully in control until the mid-20s, even though the mid to late 20s, even though Mussolini first comes to power in 1922. But we see them acting very early on to try to, Mussolini dubbed it the battle of births, or the battle for births, right? So this attempt to raise the birth rate and the passage of some of these first laws begins in 1926, 1927, and then they'll be expanded upon as we move into the 1930s.
Okay. Now, to go back to what you were saying about penalties around abortion, which, to be clear, as mm-hmm. you said, wasn't legal at the time already, but it wasn't necessarily something that had been overtly criminalized. Now, were also doctors who were performing them, or
absolutely.
People who were giving them, providing information, were laws passed to penalize those people as well?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there is a big push in this period to medicalize childbirth. I mean, childbirth still quite frequently happened at home, and it was much more likely, particularly in rural areas, if women were attended at all, for them to be attended by midwives. And midwives became the subject of really close scrutiny because they were believed to be sources of knowledge about preventing or ending pregnancies. And there was, there was a kind of syndicalization of midwives, and really kind of an attempt to replace them with medical doctors wherever possible. And, you know, this was also, this was presented in some cases, you know, in fact did have a positive effect on the kind of hygienic conditions of childbirth. But the motives behind it were really because, you know, women were suspect. Women, you know, miscarriages became something that had to be registered with the state and scrutinized, because there was this belief that women were in some ways trying to control their fertility, which they were.
So, just to remind listeners, I mean, what we're trying to explore here is if a restriction or tightening of women's rights is sort of a canary in the coal mine for a general democratic backsliding in a country. And it's, you know, it may even be kind of a difficult thing to find a perfect correlation in history, right? Because, I mean, we're talking about nations post-World War I and at the beginning of World War II, which were already in a state of political crisis because of the end of the First World War. I just want to note that, right? It's not a perfect correlation here. But would
no,
you...
absolutely not. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. No, please go ahead. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to say also that, you know, one of the problems with trying to make a correlation with some of these earlier movements is that in a lot of, not all places where fascist regimes come to power, but in a number of places, you know, women didn't really have rights to lose, mm-hmm. or didn't have as many rights to lose. And they, you know, what happened is that the gains that they were making, and which in some cases seemed inevitable, were quashed,
right.
which is alarming, and it's comparable, I suppose. But you know, in some ways, what we see today is even more alarming because we're seeing people really attempt to kind of actually turn back the clock on rights that have already been gained and that seemed to many of us to be you know, obtained, period, not in question.
Right. So let's talk about that then. How much would you say, given your knowledge of what has happened with women's rights in history, are changes in laws around abortion, et cetera, in the modern context, is it a canary in the coal mine for overall democratic backsliding?
I do think that I think that reproductive rights are an important sign for democratic backsliding, because I think they are a way in which the definition of the people in the whole notion of rule by the people gets narrowed, right? In the sense that, sorry, I'm not being very clear, but in, you know, as long as we've had this kind of concept of democracy, right, this of and by the people, a social contract among the people, there's been contestation of who gets to count as the people, right? And in some ways, the last century or more has really been about, you know, trying to define the people and trying to, you know, for various groups to trying to be admitted into full personhood. And, you know, fascism is a rejection of the notion that, you know, of equality, of an expansive definition of the people. And it comes at a time where people are pushing the parameters of an existing definition, one that basically included, you know, males, often male property owners only. You know, it was pushed back against expanding that definition to excluded groups. We, you know, what we seem to be experiencing today, to me, it looks a lot like an attempt to define down that notion of the people again. And, you know, some people get to be fully autonomous and some don't.
Right. And we're seeing that in various ways, right? I'm not saying that we have the rise of a fascist regime in the United States here, but you know, it's only very, very recently that in, for example, in the state of Missouri, there's a proposal that would effectively, not directly, but effectively, seek to bar women from leaving the state to seek an abortion. It would do so by penalizing anyone who provides information or assistance to that woman from crossing state lines. So, I mean, it's the quick rise of laws and proposals like that in the United States, I think, have many people wondering, like, how do we understand what the overall intent is or what the overall impact would be? And can we look at history to see if there are any lessons to be learned, Professor?
Yeah, I think that there is, you know, you start to get into questions of not even just intent of those laws. I mean, the intent of many of these laws, of course, is to end access to abortion. Mm-hmm. But in doing that, they're discussing, you know, ending freedom of movement for certain people of the female persuasion, and that should ring some alarm bells, regardless of one's position on reproductive rights. I think that historically, you know, again, it's always the drawing of historical parallels is always a tricky situation, and you know, we historians really, you know, we're not really equipped or trained as people who can predict the future, certainly. But I do think that, you know, the degree to which we're willing to tolerate the removal of a whole series of rights for people in defense of, you know, in defense of the a full ban on abortion, or in defense of, you know, in the pursuit of anti-crime, we want to kind of remove rights because we see them as potentially preventative of crime. We have to really seriously question, you know, to what degree we're committed to democracy.
Right, and this is why the example of in the extreme example of fascist regimes seeing the purpose of womanhood as, you know, to be the vessel by which new children are created for the state. Again, that's at the far extreme, but there are echoes in sort of the idea that, you know, in modern times with changes with abortion laws, that the woman's self is secondary to the fetus.
Right.
So we hear that explicitly in laws that have been passed just recently in the United States. I mean, here is Texas Governor Greg Abbott in May of 2021 when he signed legislation banning abortions in Texas as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy.
Our creators endowed us with the right to life, and yet millions of children lose their right to life every year because of abortion. In Texas, we work to save those lives.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott last year. So it's laws like that in Texas that have actually raised the concerns of many reproductive rights activists, including Gloria Steinem. Here she is speaking with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, also last year, December 9th, 2021.
Controlling reproduction has always been the first step in any hierarchical or authoritarian government. Those who are authoritarian or hierarchical in their outlook in this, you know, still patriarchal time, look to control the one thing they don't have as the first effort in creating a hierarchy.
It's Gloria Steinem speaking to NPR's Mary Louise Kelly in December of last year. Well, I'd like to bring into the conversation Erica Chenoweth now. Erica is a professor of public policy at Harvard University. Professor Chenoweth, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So first of all, respond to what you heard Gloria Steinem there say in that cut that we pulled when she was actually speaking last year. What do you think of her analysis of reproductive rights and authoritarianism?
Well, I think that's exactly right. You know, authoritarianism is a form of government in which there's an attempt to create centralized control and diminish political competition or severely curtail it. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to manufacture or double down on existing hierarchies so that it's clear who's at the top and who isn't. And one of the most available of these hierarchies for anyone to draw on in any society is the hierarchy between men and women between men and other people. So people who don't identify as men, including people who are trans or genderqueer.
Mm. Now, you just recently wrote about this, right, in an article titled Revenge of the Patriarchs, Why Autocrats Fear Women. So tell me a little bit about do you see a pattern, a recent pattern in the United States?
Well, yes. So this article was co-authored with Zoe Marks. And what we were doing in that article is trying to report some of our own research about the fact that global waves of democratic progress that occurred in the 20th century were largely driven by people power movements in which women played a crucial role. And in cases where women were featured prominently in anti-authoritarian or anti-colonial movements, like in Brazil and Chile and Argentina and the Philippines, Nigeria, Palestine, Poland, and the Czech Republic, basically you see larger progress toward egalitarian democracy compared to movements that were largely driven or controlled by men. And so what's really important about that research is that we find that actually fully empowered, politically active women have been a key driver of democracy around the world and key drivers of gender equality around the world.
Well, Professor Chenoweth, hang on here for a second, and Professor Winginter, stand by for a moment. We'll talk a lot more about this when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at whether women's rights and a restriction on those rights or change in the view of those rights is an early harbinger of democratic backsliding in modern countries, including here in the United States. And I'm joined today by Anne Winginter. She's a professor of history and women's studies at Loyola University Chicago's John Felice Rome Center. She's with us from Rome, Italy. And Erica Chenoweth joins us as well, professor of public policy at Harvard University. And Professor Chenoweth, I'd like to explore more with you about what you see currently in the United States and globally. And Professor Winginter, I'm keeping you with us because having that sort of historical context to go back to, I think, is going to really help us understand this moment now. But Professor Chenoweth, you've written that women's political and economic empowerment is now stalling around the world. Can you tell us what evidence you see of that?
Absolutely. So there are really four key indicators of this that my co-author and I paid attention to, and we drew on research that's done elsewhere, including the Varieties of Democracy Project and the Georgetown Women, Peace and Security Index. And really, there are four areas to pay attention to. The first is reproductive choice and autonomy. The second is increased incidence of or tolerance for domestic, sexual, and gender-based violence in a society. The third issue is basically reduced access to political, economic power and access to education. And the fourth area is the reduction of or elimination of rights, recognition, and protection for sexual and gender minorities. And so we are seeing rollbacks in all four of those areas around the world and in the United States. And I think that what's really important and intriguing right now is that we have those types of rollbacks happening around reproductive rights and autonomy, around laws that are reducing access to gender-affirming healthcare for trans children, laws trying to punish parents and families of trans children, laws trying to change school curriculum, to eliminate mentions of gender and sexual minorities, information about women's health, and of course, backlash against racial justice. All of this is happening also in the context of pretty serious and disturbing challenges to access to the ballot, representation of women at, for example, election administration roles where they are overrepresented in numbers. A variety of other laws that directly affect democracy. So as you were mentioning earlier, it's really hard to untangle the causal direction, mm-hmm. like whether reductions in women's equality affect democracy or vice versa. And I think that's less important than just knowing that they're mutually reinforcing ills, that authoritarianism and patriarchy go together. And women's equality and democracy go together.
I mean, that's why you've written that it's not a coincidence in your co-author's view of that women's equality is in the places that you note in your paper are being rolled back at a time where those same places are seeing a rise in authoritarian governance.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Professor Wingenter, you know, Professor Chenoweth brought up something really important, and that's more broadly about family. And so I wanted to go back into history a little bit here and hear from you about how the regimes that you've studied in the past really put a particular definition of family at the center of sort of why women's roles were shaped in the way they were.
Sure. I mean, with fascism in Italy, certainly the family was defined as beginning only with the birth of children, right? So, and family was understood to be a kind of, the fascists, one of the things that sort of fascist regimes have in common is this idea of not recognizing the division between the public and the private sphere, right, which is kind of central to democracy ever since the Enlightenment, this idea that there's a public and a private sphere. Mm-hmm. And the fascists make concerted efforts to control or to direct what happens even in the private sphere. So, you know, the family is understood to be patriarchal, right, with the wife subservient to the husband or to his directives and decisions. In fact, when I mentioned before that one of the pronatalist incentives was to give job preference to men who had large families, and this is, you know, revelatory of a view that it was the man who decided, right, what the, you know, how many children they would have, what the size of the family would be, and therefore, you know, was the man who could be rewarded or punished accordingly. The family with the idea of the woman at the center of the family is also, you know, helps us understand why it became also so important to mobilize women in those public ceremonies, because their presence was pointed to as a kind of symbol of the consent of the entire nation. Right, so the family as the building block of the nation. I'm not sure if that's what you were getting at, but answered your question.
Yes, no, in fact it did. And Professor Chenoweth, I'm wondering what you hear in Professor Wingenter's response.
Yes, I mean, I think that this resonates to a certain degree with what's happening in many of the states in the United States that are effectively trying to redefine the nation and who is in and who is out. Through different types of curricular changes and laws that are going, even if they don't have this intent, are going to have the effect of either erasing or kind of subjugating large proportions of the population.
Mm. So tell me more then about, you were saying that in places where women and other let's say non-male identified groups have been very active in seeking to advance rights, that those are places where democracies have historically become stronger over time. Because I think it's important for us to understand that to get a sense of what's happening in the American context today.
Absolutely. So what we did is we actually examined hundreds of different anti-authoritarian and anti-colonial movements during the post-war period through 2019. And what we found is that when women were represented in large numbers in the front lines of those movements, they were much more likely to result in the toppling of those authoritarian regimes or colonial regimes, and the transition to more egalitarian democracy. And egalitarian democracy is important. It's a kind of democracy in which resources are more equally shared and in which social groups have equal access to power. So it's sort of the vision of, in this country's terms, what a genuine multiracial feminist democracy would actually look like. And of course, it's important to point out that the project of gender equality and the project of achieving egalitarian democracy has never been fully completed or equally shared around the world. But it's also important not to underestimate how much progress was made over the past 100 years toward those visions. And I think that, you know, what our research also shows is that when women participate in very large numbers in these movements, and they don't result in those breakthroughs, in other words, they don't topple the autocratic regime, there is a much greater patriarchal backlash. So if you think about Turkey, for example, in 2013, there was a large uprising called the Gezi Park Uprising. It was kind of notoriously inclusive of women and LGBTQ groups, students, people from all walks of life. And in the aftermath of that movement, which failed to create a democratic breakthrough in that country, in fact, Turkey has backslid in democracy since then, kind of year over year. We also see Erdogan and others in his government beginning to roll back their commitments to expanding women's rights in basically every area. There have been violent attacks on pride parades. There have been all sorts of other really difficult and troubling trends that reflect exactly this issue of patriarchal backlash coinciding with authoritarian backsliding in a country that many people pointed to 20 years ago as a sign of genuine progress in the global project of democratization.
Well, Professor Wingenter, I wonder if you could help us understand what the role of women was in upending fascism, Italian fascism, since that's your area of expertise. Now, again, we had the Second World War here, but internally to Italy, is there a story to be told about women and the resistance there?
No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, women played key roles in the Italian resistance movement. It's interesting because very often their involvement in the resistance, you know, came from not necessarily a political background or a political conviction, but from the place that they had been relocated for the 20 years of fascism, like from the family, right, in support of husbands, fathers, brothers, you know, lovers who had taken up arms in the resistance. And they were very often instrumental in carrying supplies and bringing messages, and in some cases took up arms themselves, although that was rare, but also organizing work stoppages and strikes and things like that. And when you read the memoirs of these women or listen to interviews with them, you find almost universally that they see their participation in the resistance as their political awakening, right? So it wasn't so much that they had these political convictions that brought them to protest. I mean, that was the case for some, but by far the minority, but rather that it was in taking action against the fascists, against the German occupiers during the last stage of the war, that was the sort of discovery of democracy for them. And then that carries over into post-war political activity.
You know, as we round to the last few minutes of the show here, Professor Chenoweth, I want to ask you something about what Professor Wingenter said at the very, very beginning of the program, because I can understand if a lot of listeners, tuning in to the program today or listening right now are feeling a sense of discomfort that we're even, you know, bringing together the idea of fascist Italy or Nazi Germany or fascist Spain and the treatment of women and other minorities in those regimes with cultural and political shifts in the United States. it is an uncomfortable topic. I will grant that. But we have to sort of dwell in discomfort to understand what's going on now. But to be clear, I'm not saying there's a one-to-one comparison at all, which is why there's something that Professor Winginter said earlier that I'd like to hear you on. Because she talked about how even before the creation of fascism in Italy, years before that, there was already a sense of a crisis of masculinity that may have been brought about even by the Industrial Revolution. I think we are seeing that same sort of perceived crisis of masculinity amongst, you know, particularly far-right groups in the United States now, right? There's a real focus on manhood in America and recapturing some sense of the American man. Is there any echo there, Professor Chenoweth?
Yes, well, you know, I was thinking about that when you were speaking about this earlier, because there are certainly expressions of this. We've had a U.S. Senator, Josh Hawley, kind of have a speech that he gave a few months ago where he talked exactly about the crisis of American manhood and the need to reclaim it. You know, Madison Cawthorn, who's a representative from North Carolina, you know, gave an interview a few months back in which he said that he didn't want American families to raise soft children. He wanted them to raise their boys as, quote, monsters. And, you know, there is this attempt, I think, to exactly redefine and strengthen the image of men in a certain way. You know, I'm not sure that this is exactly the same as what we saw during the Industrial Revolution's kind of crisis of masculinity, but we certainly have a lot of people talking about it in terms that at least they seem to think make it an existential struggle of their time. Certainly much of it, again, is backlash to what they perceive as a sort of existentially threatening level of inclusion of gender and sexual minorities in the country in public life, and the ways in which they perceive that to be targeting what they think of as the traditional man and his role in society.
Well, we have about 1 minute left. So, Professor Winginter, you're going to get the last word here. What's the lesson or thought that you'd like listeners to come away with from this analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd like to just kind of pick up on what Professor Chenoweth was just saying, in that, I mean, I think that this, you know, current crisis of masculinity, which I certainly perceive also in movements that are taking place here in Europe, you know, it goes back to the attempts, many of them very successful over the course of the latter part of the 20th century, to expand that definition of the people, right, to include the poor, to include ethnic and religious and linguistic minorities, to include women. And, you know, conceptually, that seems really simple. Okay, you're in. But, you know, when you are giving people access to a system that was predicated on them not counting, that system itself has to be shaken. And, you know, I think we're seeing some reaction against what it really means to, you know, to recognize the full personhood of all of these groups.
Right,
and, you
right.
know, people are threatened by it.
Well, Anne Winginter, Professor of History and Women's Studies at Loyola University Chicago's John Felice Rome Center, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
And Erica Chenoweth, Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University. Professor Chenoweth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.